This is a production of Cornell University.
It is 4:32. I'll go ahead and call this meeting of the University Assembly to order. And I would like to start this evening's meeting with our land acknowledgement. Cornell University is located on the traditional homeland of the Gayagono, the Cayuga Nation. The Gayagono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy perceived this as the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gayagono dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of Gayagono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. So with that, I will turn it over to Casey to do roll call for us.
Ian Afishola.
Present.
Present on you.
Yeah. Can you hear us?
Can you hear
me? Oh, we got you there, Ian. You muted really quickly, but we heard you.
Okay, perfect. Valerie Amer.
Excuse.
Right. Marcy Benda.
Here.
Richard Benzel?
Here.
Duncan Cady?
Here.
Nicola Dana?
Present.
Eve DeRosa?
I think it's here.
Yeah.
Jacob Fite?
Here.
Brendan Fortenberry?
Here.
Thomas Fox?
Here.
Preston Hanley?
Here.
David Heiner?
Here.
Deborah Howell?
Here.
Carolyn Levine? Manaya Lewis? Annalia Nunez, here. James Richards?
Here.
Damian Sharp?
Here.
Jessica Withers?
Here.
And that's 17 for him.
All right. Thank you very much.
Sorry, 16.
What's that?
16.
Okay, and we'll update the folks who join into the Zoom afterwards. Thank you so much. And I forgot to grab a copy of the agenda, but usually we'll do a quick call for late additions. Any additions to the agenda? Any call for late additions? Any additions to the agenda? All right, seeing none, our next item on the agenda is for the approval of the minutes. Thank you very much, Beth. Approval of the minutes from the February 8th. I will open the floor to any discussion or motions for approval.
Move to approve.
Richard has moved to approve. Do I have a second?
Second.
A second from Preston. Thank you. Any opposition? Seeing none, the meeting minutes are approved from February 8th. Well, with that then, we will move right in. I'd like to welcome back to the University Assembly our President Martha E. Hollis and Vice President for University Relations, Joel Molina. And I'll turn the floor over to you.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. Really good to see you, whether you're here or in Zoom. I got a number of topics that you want me to talk about, so I'm going to go through those as quickly as I can before opening up to questions. First of all, I was delighted that you wanted to hear about academic distinctions. That's something I focus on all the time. And so I want to start by just mentioning a very small number, five, in fact, of the many, many faculty awards that we've received recently that I think illustrate some of the academic distinctions here. Naminata Diabante, who is an associate professor of comparative literature, was recently awarded the African Study Association's Best Book Prize for her book, Naked Agency, Genital Cursing and Biopolitics in Africa. This is one of the ASA's 2021 awards for Africanists. It recognizes the most important scholarly work in academic studies published in English and distributed in the United States during the preceding year. Another example is Deborah Estrin, affiliate faculty at Weill Cornell Medicine and associate dean, and the Robert V. Tishman 37 professor at Cornell Tech. She was named 2022 recipient of a prize that I know because it's in my own field is extremely prestigious, and that is the IEEE, the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers John von Neumann Medal. And she was cited for her leadership in mobile and wireless sensing system technologies and applications, including personal health management. Richard Kiley, who is a senior fellow in the David M. Einhorn Center for Community Engagement, was inducted into a relatively new group, the Academy of Community Engaged Scholarship. This was founded in 2013 to highlight scholarship with a direct impact on social issues. Morton H. Christensen, the William R. Kennan Jr. Professor of Psychology, an expert in a topic that I personally find completely fascinating, the evolution of language. How did we come to speak to one another? He was elected a foreign member of the Royal Danish Academy of Sciences and Letters. And our new dean of the Jebby Brooks School of Public Policy, Colleen Berry, was elected to the National Academy of Social Insurance in recognition of her national prominence as a health and policy scholar. I could go on and on and on, but I picked these five because I think they really illustrate the incredible breadth of excellence of Cornell faculty. I'm going to let me give one example at the programmatic level. We have a newly established Center for Integrative Developmental Sciences in the College of Human Ecology. This will strengthen Cornell as an interdisciplinary leader in human development research across the lifespan, bringing together a range of diverse expertise from cognitive, social, emotional, cultural, and biological systems that characterize human development from infancy right through old age. And I think our academic distinction also extends, of course, to the pandemic and to COVID-19 research and care. And so on that note, we were really pleased to welcome Senator Kirsten Gillibrand here to Ithaca on January 7th. She was highlighting the bipartisan COVID-19 and Pandemic Response Centers of Excellence Act. This was a bill that was introduced by Senator Gillibrand and Senator Bill Cassidy, Republican from Louisiana, and it was developed with the help of our physicians and faculty at Weill Cornell Medicine. It's a proposed legislation, a piece of legislation, that would award $10 million each to at least 10 different U.S. academic centers, authorizing a total of $500 million, half a billion dollars. And it would provide resources to these academic medical centers, not only to continue the incredibly important work of understanding and combating COVID-19, but also to provide a framework for these centers of excellence to stay out in front of future pandemics. Before I move on from academic distinction, I want to add a related point, and that is our university-wide philanthropic campaign. I mentioned it briefly at my last visit. Thanks to the generosity of our alumni and friends and the incredible work of our alumni affairs and development staff, the months of January 1st through December 31st, so the first 6 months of this year, for our best ever first half for philanthropy, we raised the highest amount of funding ever in Cornell's history, $528 million overall, which brings us up to a total of about $3 billion towards our $5 billion goal. This will help us address a range of important priorities, including one of our key priorities, one of the ones I'm working the hardest at and that I'm proudest of, and that's the goal of making undergraduate education more affordable. We've now raised, we're more than halfway to our $500 million goal. We've raised $253 million towards our goal of undergraduate access and affordability. And if you want later, I can tell you about the specifics of what we're going to do in that way. But we've also made strong progress on our other critical goals, including $1.36 billion for faculty and research support. So again, just a couple of examples. Very, very recently, Joan Knight gave a $15 million gift in honor of her late husband, Charles Chuck Field Knight, to establish the Charles Field Knight Deanship in the Cornell S.C. Johnson College of Business. That's going to provide the dean with discretionary money that he can use to carry all kinds of priorities. And then last week, we got a $12.1 million gift from the Dave and Cheryl Duffield Foundation, yes, the same Duffield that named Duffield Hall, to create a new Duffield Institute for Animal Behavior and a new professorship for an expert in animal behavior. So that's pretty exciting, too. Overall, we've raised more than $200 million for endowed professorships, including 11 new positions since July, and that continues to be a very high priority given our commitment to academic distinction. And finally, of course, academic distinction also requires that we have outstanding graduate and professional students, and to date, we've raised over $335 million for graduate and professional scholarships and for postdoctoral programs. Let me turn to wellness, which is something else that you will ask about. Look, I don't have to tell you, we're reaching the 2-year anniversary of the pandemic. We've all faced travel stresses, we've all faced challenges, caregiving, in-person work, remote work, physical health, mental health. You know, everyone's challenges are different, but I don't think there's anyone who has escaped the challenges of the pandemic. And so with the leadership of Vice President and Human Resources, Chief Human Resources Officer Mary Opperman, and Vice President for Student Campus Life, Ryan Lombardi, we have tried to meet as many of our community's needs as possible through a range of programs and resources. We're bringing back some of the face-to-face programs that can help us connect one another. So, for example, Soup and Hope is back. If you haven't been there, you can go. It has a Zoom option. We have to figure out a way to have delivery of soup, per se, but at least you can participate in the conversations. Recreational facilities have reopened for spouses, partners, and retirees. For students, the new Business Center in Toni Morrison Hall opens. It is available to all students, not just students of Toni Morrison. And this is important. I want to make sure people know this. We do charge a membership for our business centers, but a new feature of our access fund is that students for whom it's an obstacle, students who can't afford memberships, can get either an access grant to help cover their membership, or if they have student health insurance plans, the dues are reimbursable. And we found that a lot of students don't know this. So if you know students who would benefit from this knowledge, let them know. They can go talk to the folks in the first generation and lower income student center. They can go talk to Marla Love, the Dean of Students. We have resources for students, so please let them know. There's a lot of work going on as we roll out the recommendations of the mental health review. I won't take time to go through them all. I can give you more information again during Q&A if you want. But take a look on the website, and you can see a detailed list of all the things being done. And take a look at, you know, you can Google, I think it's Cornell Wellbeing Newsletter. It has really just a wealth of information on, you know, an online series about mental health in the Black community, mental health and special education workshops for caregivers, a spousal law support group. Take a look at the things that are being offered there. Okay, what else? I got a specific question about Cornell's pools. We know that our pools are old, and we've increasingly been having maintenance challenges with them. We did invest $1.1 million in them a few years ago, just before the pandemic. We had problems this fall of cloudy water that affects safety, among other things. We're aware of the problem, and we're looking at solutions. I'm going to be honest with you. It's expensive. It's very, very expensive. But we know we have to do something about it, and we're trying to figure out some sort of creative approach to funding the problem. That said, I want to turn to the next question, which is, wages and increases for the next fiscal year, because again, you know, you spend money here, you have less money there, you spend money there, you have less money here. So we're always trying to balance all of this. The FY23 budget, so that's the budget for July 1 of 2022 through June, so this is the one starting this summer through the next academic year. That budget will include the final decisions on annual wage increases. So we don't have that yet. We don't have that until May. But I want to tell you a little bit about the process we use to decide on what the salary improvement pool will be, the SIP, the salary improvement plan. So we determine that percentage in the context of budget for the overall university, but we also take account things like overall market pay. By far, our largest expense is wages and benefits. That's by far the largest expense. And by far the largest portion of our revenue comes from tuition. So the challenge we face every year is balancing our need to provide ample compensation to our faculty and staff, make sure they're well paid, we don't want anyone underpaid, while at the same time restraining tuition growth. And it's especially challenging right now because there is so much volatility and so much uncertainty. We're in a pandemic, we've got all these situations we need to plan for, we're trying to keep tuition increases as low as possible. We want to continue to honor our commitment to keep raising financial aid, let students with financial need don't see increases. And the inflation that is absolutely impacting all of our faculty and staff, and we want to take account of, is also impacting our costs. When we budget, there's all kinds of inflation factors we can use. We use something called the ECI, the Employment Cost Index, which is a survey conducted by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and it measures the change in total employee compensation across the university. And when we use it to plan for a fiscal year, we use the previous year's annualized number. So we're working July to June, we're using the annualized number from the previous year, and that smooths out some of the volatility that we would otherwise see. Now, I know there is a lot of concern around inflation and high prices. We will do the very best we can to raise salaries as much as we can while remaining true to the long-term fiscal responsibilities that we have for the university. When we add something to the budget here, we have to find someplace else to take it out there. I do want to mention the endowment. I can tell you again more about the endowment in the Q&A. The endowment did very, very well last year. But you have to understand that, first of all, it doesn't do very, very well every year. The year before it did, frankly, pretty dreadful. This year it's doing well, but below inflation. And all of that money is locked into designated funds. Now, when it moves to that fund, it can free up some other money, but it can't just be reassigned willy-nilly to salaries and wages. So we are looking at this very carefully. We're exploring all of our options. And for the long run, of course, as I said, one of the things we're doing is we're trying to increase our philanthropy. We can raise more money for financial aid through the endowment. We can use that money to create money for other costs, but that's the long run. Okay, just two more topics. One you didn't mention, but I had to throw in here, and that is I want to take a moment to congratulate our Olympic athletes from Cornell. Team Canada. Team Canada had four women on their women's hockey team. I'll read you the names. Brianne Jenner, 15, Rebecca Johnston, 12, Jill Sonnier, 15, and Micah Zandi, 20. And also our current coach, Doug Darrow, the coach of the women's hockey team. I was an assistant coach for that team. So congratulations to them. And of course, Karen Chen was a current student, class of 23, won a gold medal in figure skating. We got our first Ivy League championship of the year in wrestling. Okay. Let me close with sustainability, because that's another last thing that you asked me about. Again, another area we're working very hard on. We just earned our second platinum sustainability rating. That's the highest one you can get from the Association for the Advancement of Sustainability in Higher Education, ASHI. We're the only Ivy League institution to have won this twice, and only six in the world. In fact, only two in the United States. You want to guess who the other one is?
MIT?
Yeah, Stanford. You've heard me say
it.
Stanford. And they have a lot easier heating situation than we have. Part of this, of course, not all, this comes from a broad range of sustainability activities. But part does come from our efforts to explore earth source heating. And we now have in hand a $7.2 million grant from the Department of Energy. And so we're on track to begin digging the Cornell University borehole, UBO. It's a 10,000-foot hole, and that will give us really essential data on the viability of scaling up. And I want to close with one more piece of sustainability research, in part because I just think it's really cool, and in part because it's a nice example, it's such a nice example of the high-impact research we do here. So close as a circle brings me right back to academic discussion. So there's something called rare earth elements. And rare earth elements are used in almost everything we do. They're in cell phones, they're in wind turbines, they're in electrical vehicles, they're in sonars, they're in LED lights, they're in rechargeable batteries. But when you refine these rare earth elements, it's not only expensive, but it's inefficient and it's really environmentally harmful. So we have a group of Cornell researchers led by Buzz Barstow, who is an assistant professor of biological and environmental engineering at Cal. And they are working to develop, because it's a bug that does the job better. It manipulates genes with a type of bacteria to dissolve rock and then create bacteria, it manipulates the genes of a bacteria that dissolves rock, and then you can extract rare earth elements from the ore once you've done that dissolving. So I just thought that was a really cool, nice example of this sort of thing we do at Cornell. Brandon,
with that, I'll turn it back over to you. Well, thank you very much, President Hollis. That was a cool fact to end with. Bugs that eat rocks to make
rare earth elements.
Well, I wanted to start where we have a few questions that we submitted to President Hollis in advance. And I believe you answered the first one that speaks to the metrics that determine the impact, the response to inflation and cost of living. So you talked about the ECI and how you look at that. So.
Let me just add one point to that, because that question also asked about financial aid. And what I want to know is when we compute, because this is how students get their cost of living calculations. So tuition, we know what that is. Room and board for on-campus students, we know what that is. For everything else, for the incidentals and travels, we actually do a student survey. So we get actual data on what students are reporting those costs are.
And the other question was just around graduate student payments, and that many institutions have already implemented significant increases in the payments to graduate students. And while this isn't on there, I would just like to add as well, so asking the question of how we're looking at graduate students, I think that applies across the university faculty staff. And I just want to state that I believe we're at a precipice sort of moment where staff have an option, faculty have an option, students have a significant number of options. And a lack of response to what is happening as it pertains to inflation and the cost of living increases, I feel personally, and I'm not speaking on behalf of the entire University Assembly, but there is a detrimental moment where there isn't a significant reaction or opportunity here that we have significant opportunity.
Yeah, and again, I agree, we are looking part of that. I do want you to keep that in mind when we think about other costs like building this wing, because if I take the money from here, at this moment, I don't have the money at this moment to put it somewhere else. That doesn't mean in the long term, because our costs are going up to. Let me speak to the graduate student one. We are absolutely planning a bigger stipend increase than we have in the past. When we look at the rate for students, we look at inflation, but we also look at competitiveness, we look at cost of living in the local region, we look at what faculty grants can afford, because many of our students are supported on faculty grants, and that's important. We've been for a number of years sort of in the middle of the Ivy Plus. Some are a little higher, some are a little lower. One thing we've done that is helpful to graduate students when you look at the numbers is we have a single floor. We don't distinguish between RAs and TAs, as is the case at other universities, and you know, that I used to do. One thing I want to be clear about this, these, you know, huge numbers you've seen, is not what they're applied to. So Princeton, which, by the way, is much wealthier than Cornell. Princeton's endowment per student is 10 times, more than 10 times ours, so we'll never be able to do. When Princeton just announced a 25% increase in the graduate student stipends, they end up at stipends that range from $38,000 to $42,000. Our current stipend, even before any new increase, minimum is $38,205. So again, we are going to increase them, but I think, you know, just because somebody announces a huge increase, you've got to look at what it is increase on. We are absolutely working on this. We're looking really hard at what we can do.
Thank you. I'll open the floor if there's any follow-up questions or comments from that statement. Okay, our next question.
Go ahead.
All right, so the next question says, over the last 10 years or so, there have been an almost perfect correlation between increasing Cornell collaboration with academic institutions in China.
Can I interrupt you here? I answered this exact question last month. Do you really want, last time I was here, do you really want me to repeat?
Martha, you did not answer the question last time.
Okay, I'll give you the same answer I gave last time.
Well, I asked it actually of the Vice President for Vice Provost for International Affairs, and she refused to answer it too. Why doesn't the Cornell statement on academic freedom apply to Cornell programs outside the United States? That is straightforward.
Richard,
answer.
My answer is the same answer I gave you last month.
What was that
support,
answer?
We don't support academic boycotts. They are at odds with our commitment to academic freedom. They are at odds with our commitment to the open exchange of ideas. They close the very lines of communication we want open. I respect the academic freedom of our faculty to decide what research they do and where. And I stand by the protection of our students and their academic freedom. The partners in other countries all agree to non-discrimination and academic freedom, and we retain the right to cancel a program or pull out when we have concerns. That's my answer. Same answer I gave you last.
Well, let me press you a little bit on that. That's not an answer. Does the statement for academic freedom that Cornell abides by and has adopted, does it or does it not apply to programs abroad?
We require each program abroad to uphold non-discrimination and academic freedom.
Okay. Martha, I asked Wendy Wolford that question, and she said basically that. And then I asked her for evidence that Cornell actually looked at these programs. And the answer to that, she didn't answer it directly, but the answer seems to be no. So how do you know this?
That's not true. Part of it is, again, I defer back to the faculty who are doing the research and teaching. You saw this play out with the ILR program in China, where the faculty determined that there wasn't sufficient academic freedom and closed the program down. So we have a point of evidence that this works. And part of the reason we built the global hubs is so that we would have even more insight into this. But it's not that I don't want to debate this with you. It's that unless it's of interest to the biggest group, I have 15 minutes, and I feel like we take all of our time on the same question.
I'm very happy to debate you on this. It is a primary concern to the Faculty Senate. I represent a constituency that has passed resolutions on this issue. We have inquired over and over again on this, and the central administration has not reported on the Global Hubs program to the Faculty Senate yet. So there's the problem is.
I talked about the global hub the last time I went.
You. That's not a report.
I want to allow for others if others have.
That's fine. That's fine,
Brandon. The question has been stated, and the president has provided the response. If there are others who would like to provide comment as well on the question, I would open the floor to other members of the assembly. And if not, I believe we would move forward with the next question. With that, then we will move forward to the next question.
Go ahead.
Thank you. The next question here is a question about the growth on campus. So we have the North Campus expansion, the growth campus housing, and the eventual increase in registration numbers. And I don't know if you have those figures.
I do.
I would love, that's great, because I had them off the top of my head, but it was some time ago. The questions that are being asked here is, how are you determining a plan for increased services? We already talked about well-being. There are many more services needed. And what limits do you see to putting into place to ensure that Cornell maintains its size and the culture that so many people have chosen Cornell for, and keeping an eye on the faculty-to-student ratio so that students have that same experience?
So it's a really important question, and it is something we are keeping our eye on. So let me first give you the numbers. So our target, which this target was set actually 5 years ago, just before I got here, when the decision was made to open the North Campus residence halls, our target is 15,800 students by 2025. Currently, we have 15,500. So you're talking about 300 more students. And just prior to COVID 2 years ago, I mean, forget the in-between year where numbers were down. Just prior to COVID, we had 15,200. So we're talking about a growth of about 600 students. That is a lot, but it's not, you know, I hear these stories about 2,000, 3,000. That's the target. There is no plan whatsoever. I won't, could I say never? I can't say never. But right now, there is absolutely no plan to go beyond that. In terms of academics, what we're doing is we're looking to allocate those slots to the schools and programs and colleges that have the capacity. We have some programs that are over capacity, we have some that are over, under, and so the answer number one is to allocate those slots to the places that have capacity. Number two, you look to strengthen departments where there is just huge demand and oversubscription. So my own tenure home, the Bowers College, is wildly oversubscribed. The student-faculty ratio is just higher than anywhere else on the campus, so we look to hire there. And then finally, this is on the faculty side, as I mentioned, part of our capital campaign involves raising money for endowed faculty, so we can not only hire more faculty, but we can retain our top faculty by giving them named chairs and or hire in other top faculty with those chairs. Outside of that, you know, when you look at services and support, there's really two big areas, right? There's facilities, and then there's student services. So with facilities, you know, we're trying to deal with that. In fact, the decision to grow the number of students was predicated on the opening not just of the residence hall, but the dining hall and the fitness center and so on up there. On the support side, it's all about staff, and that's where we've been investing. So over the past 5 years, the biggest areas where we've grown staff have been in student campus life and research, because our faculty have also really been stepping up their research and needing more research support. We've added, this is over 5 years, 250 staff to student services, more than 100 staff to health professionals. So, you know, it's a matter of using the tuition money to make sure that the students have the facilities and the support that they need. And the faculty.
Great. Well, thank you very much. Those are the submitted questions we have here. And I see if you might go to, says Duncan first.
No, no, I'll
recognize Jacob.
Well, first of all, I just want to say thank you for that answer. That was a question that I had submitted because I felt as an undergraduate student that not only are the resources per se stretched thin, but the prospects of adding more students would only worsen that situation, but it is clear that that the administration is taking a deliberate approach in the way that it not only adds students or plans to add enrollment, but also resources. I have two follow-up questions on that. One is, what mechanisms are in place to ensure that the faculty size is not only growing, but growing in a way that is diverse and keeping up with the growing diversity of our student population, one. Two, is a concern with housing as it relates to expanding our student population. Housing prices are skyrocketing. I mean, I live in College Town, and I guess what is considered the most affordable version of housing that exists now, and all the rest of the houses on my block are being torn down and replaced with luxury apartments. Many other schools offer. four-year housing options for students. And that's especially useful for students who are low income or even middle-class students who possibly can't even keep up with the rising crisis. So how does the administration
On the first is an incredibly important question, and I'm really proud of the fact that our faculty have stepped up, because it's up to our faculty to make the hiring decisions. And there have been a number of really important and really good programs over just the past couple of years. I mean, we've always looked for faculty who bring diversity of a range of ways. But there have been, over the past 2 years, I guess, I can point to at least four different programs. There was a cluster program in the College of Human Ecology that was focused on faculty who bring diverse perspectives. And so these get cast between diverse perspectives and social justice, and sort of in that space or broadly. So there was a program in the College of Human Ecology that brought in six faculty. There's a program right now in Art, Architecture, and Planning that's looking for six faculty, plus, I believe, an associate dean. There's a cluster hire in CALS. I don't know the number of faculty. I think it's five, but don't quote me on that. And then Avery August, who is the Vice Provost for Academic Affairs, is the PI on a very large grant called FIRST, which seeks to bring in 10 faculty with diverse backgrounds and perspectives into the sciences. So we are working very hard on that. And I'm, you know, it's a long road, but because you also have to work on diversifying the pipeline. But I feel like we are making progress. I don't have as good an answer to you on the housing issue. When I got here, we couldn't even house all our freshmen and sophomores. Now at least we can house our freshmen and sophomores. We don't have the money right now to build dormitories for juniors and seniors, and we don't really control. I mean, part of the reason for building the 2,000 extra beds was we thought it would put pressure on the local housing market to drive down costs. Well, what it seems to have done is put local pressure on the local. It did to some extent, but it also put pressure on the local housing market to build nicer apartments, but as you say, they tend to be luxury apartments. We are doing what we can. I don't know, Joel, did you have anything you
want to add? Just look to the model of Maplewood, which we saw as an affordable, thanks to the involvement of the GPSA at the time. That's the type of message that I think was a strong one to local landlords. My office in community relations spends a lot of time talking to the College Town Neighborhood Association, including the landlords, who are the major players in the area. It's a very complicated set of business and economic decisions that we can't control, but we do have this ability through external forces to try to shape the marketplace. And I think we've made good progress, as the president suggested, but there's plenty more.
And you know, unfortunately, the housing market right now, nationally, I mean, I have a daughter who's looking to buy a house. She's in her 30s to buy a house. This is not an excuse. This is unfortunately. The housing market is just crazy, crazy everywhere. And something needs to do, but I wish I had a better answer.
Thank you both so much. I'll go to Duncan, and then James has his hand up.
President Paul, thanks again for coming. Nice talking a little bit in the elevator for a second there. On that point, I will also say I'm from San Francisco. I'm trying to move to New York City after graduation. Okay. Still a little ways away, but I hear you on it's a competitive housing market, especially for young folk. I'd love to touch base a little bit first, kind of going off of Representative Fike's question along increasing faculty and staff relevant to the increase in students. Specifically, I want to talk about something I've touched base on most of our conversations, which is student wellness and mental health. Uh-huh. Specifically, I believe you said 100 health officers were hired.
100 health professionals. I don't have the breakdown. I don't actually have the breakdown.
I'd love to hear just like how mental health is being prioritized in that. I did get a chance since our last conversation to go in depth in reading, I'm forgetting the full title now, but the most previous mental health report. And it's great to see the university's intentions are in the right direction. I'm just curious how those goals are going to be continued to be pursued within possible new hires. As well as I also wanted to touch base a little bit on what you said about wellness in regards to the gym, but I can get that.
So as you know, there was a very, very extensive mental health review. It had an external review and an internal review.
Something I'm encouraging all students to read.
The recommendations came out, and Catherine Bohr is actually now chairing the committee, the implementation committee. I really urge you, I started to actually write down because I knew I wouldn't remember them all, and there's so many. I urge you to look at mental health review progress, Google that, because there are a number of things, everything from They're looking back at how we do student of concern notifications to faculty. So there's a program being rolled out to teach how to be better mentors.
Maybe the years program?
No, there's a separate program for graduate student mentors. The years program is another example. We hired Mantra, which is to do telehealth and the evening for students after hours. There's a whole new delivery mechanism so that students can be connected. And one statistic I found very interesting is that the uptake, the use of mental health services has actually been flat over the last 4 years. I thought it would have increased, but it's been bumping around between like 10.5% and 14%. This semester was right in there. So it's not that we're seeing an enormous increase in the percentage of students accessing mental health. That said, it is critically important. I mean, that's why we did the mental health review. And I think what the university is really trying to do, and it's Ryan Lombardi, who is the point person on this, spearheading this, is look not just at CAPS, not just narrowly at hiring more staff for CAPS, but looking at this broader set of wellness issues. And that's why, for example, a paying for gym memberships is part of this. Is that?
Yeah, that was I was going to ask that more as a separate question. And I'm happy you highlighted use cases. I'm a student who's personally seen a lot of how complex this process is, given that there's often students with health insurance at home and other telehealth options around New York State that can complicate the process. So I appreciate you answering
that. And let me give you an example of how complicated it is. So people often say to us, well, you know, why don't you just go to the student's health? And of course, the problem is the health, the student's health may be the parent's health insurance. You know, all these issues come in.
I'd love to check in on that mental health review process.
Take a look. Yeah.
But I'm kind of going into the gym part. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the access grants and student health plan reimbursement, just so you could talk a little bit about what the direct path for students is like in subsidizing.
I don't know the details of that.
Sure.
I would urge you to go. I just don't know.
There isn't like a single office or single.
There may be. I don't know. But if you follow up either with the Office of First Generation and Long-Term Students or with Marla Love, the Dean of Students, she can tell. I'm sorry. I just
appreciate that. Thank you.
I'll move to James now, and then if respecting the time, we have time for two questions.
Yes.
Okay. First, James, and then Donald.
Okay.
Go ahead, James.
So hi, President Pollack. First, I want to say thank you for coming today. My question is a pretty brief one, but basically, I recently read an article in the Wall Street Journal which stated that alumni of major schools, including Cornell, are withholding contributions due to free speech concerns. And I'm just wondering if the school is aware of this article and whether it's given this claim any credibility, and if so, steps are being taken to remedy this.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I saw the article too. We have not seen it. There, on any given day, there is at least one alumni who is not giving money because of some concern they have. I am deeply concerned about free speech. I think that I've always been concerned about free speech. I mean, you can hear when I came here and some talks I gave about it. And I think at this moment, we are under attack, not just from the left, not just from the right, but from both sides of the political spectrum in terms of free speech. And I think it's worrisome you see surveys. I find it worrisome. There are surveys of students. There is a real generational issue. So if you ask students, there's often a tension between how much speech you allow and how hard you work to create a welcoming and inclusive environment. I want a welcoming and inclusive environment. That's also something I am passionately committed to. But sometimes people say things that are offensive, and you have to decide where you draw that line. And I think it's an incredibly important problem, an issue. And in fact, I'll tell you, I've been thinking about coming on my 5th year anniversary, and I've been thinking about goals for my next 5 years. And one of the things I'm thinking about is getting a working group of students and faculty and staff together to think about these issues. But I do know, I did see the article, and it is something we pay attention to. We don't make decisions on the basis of whether an alumnus or alumna is going to give us money. We make decisions on the basis of what's right.
Okay, President Pollack.
Thank you.
Hi, President Pollack. Thank you so much for joining us today. I have a quick question, which I feel like is the question we're getting all the time right now, just about COVID, particularly with the upcoming breaks with February break and then the spring break, and the surge that we saw in Omicron at the end of last year. I was just curious if the university has a plan in place for that. I know that I saw with the email that we got last week about just testing and coming back, but just wondering how we're thinking about COVID moving forward, especially in our current grading status.
Yeah, so it's a really good question. My answer is kind of a simple one. It's what we've done all along. We follow the science. We continue to model. We continue to look at sort of projected cases based on what the science tells us, based on what part of the population is vaccinated and so on. But whereas early in the pandemic, we were really counting cases. Our goal was to minimize cases. We now understand, first of all, that we're in a completely different circumstance. It's still a dangerous disease for people who are older, for people who are immunocompromised, for people who haven't been vaccinated. Our entire population is vaccinated, but people still have little kids at home, faculty who are not vaccinated. But for most of us, given vaccinations and given the kinds of therapeutics and so on, for most of it's a manageable disease at this point. Long COVID is an issue. We don't have a solution to that, although there is growing evidence. I just saw an article yesterday. There's growing evidence that vaccines do significantly are likely, and this is all changing, but are likely to significantly decrease your chances of that. So, sorry, long-winded answer. What we're trying to do is figure out, we can't shut down now every time there's a surge. So we're trying to figure out what can we do to keep our community as safe as possible while also allowing as much as possible. You know, I hate to use the phrase, but learning to live with COVID. At this point, for example, we're still requiring masks because we have faculty members and staff members who have little kids at home and we want to protect them, are taking care of immunocompromised or elder family members. Over time, that's going to have to change too. Right now, there are no plans to constrain spring break, but we hope people will be reasonably careful, and if they travel, we'll get tested and then come back. Thank you.
Well, thank you all so much for the question today. Thank you, President Pollack and CEO Galileo. We appreciate your time.
See ya.
Have a great evening. All right. Well, thank you all so much. And now we'll move on to the next item in our agenda. We would like to welcome up here Ashley Newman, who is going to do a presentation on the term that I learned as a result of the natatorium. I have no idea that that meant something with a pool in it. It may be wrong in actually what the actual definition of a natatorium is. So with no further ado, I'll welcome Ashley Newman up. And you should be able to share your screen now, Ashley.
Okay, let me do that. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, you can.
Probably.
Just a reminder, folks, we have food here if anybody would like to help themselves to food while we're seeing the presentation. Go ahead, Ashley.
Hey, thank you. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak today. It's truly an honor. And what I want to start off is with the reality that unless we act now, Cornell will be without a functioning pool. Basically, we have a time gap problem where the pools have a finite lifespan that can end any time between now and 2025. And it takes at least 10 years as a conservative estimate to plan and construct a new pool. And therefore, we have this period of time where we may have none on campus. So the goal of this resolution is to provide facts on the current state of the pools and implore the administration to act and make a new natatorium a priority. You may be asking yourself, why should I care? You know, is this is a varsity problem or I don't swim? Well, you may be interested to find out that 742 faculty, staff, and retirees swam in open swim in 2018 to 2019. And that's the last year of complete data prior to the COVID shutdown. And 1,875 students swam in open swim during that time. And then you have approximately another 600 students that are members of the variety of groups I've listed here. And it's also worthwhile to note that children in the community, ages 4 to 14, also use the pools during the Cornell University Big Red Sport summer camps, and they use that for recreation time. My personal connection to this issue is I swam growing up all throughout my life. I believe in swimming. I was a 4-year varsity swimmer at Cornell during my undergrad years, and I was co-captain in my senior year. I happened to meet my husband during that time, and he is the current head coach of the men's varsity swim team. And I would be mistaken not to wish them good luck. They are currently on a bus ride to Princeton as we speak for the Ivy League championships. The benefits of aquatic exercise are obviously physical health, but mental health. And we know that that is an important issue right now for Cornell. Swimming has been shown to improve self-esteem in college students, as well as act as a preventative measure to combat depression, winter blues, and the more severe seasonal affective disorder. The pools at Cornell, we have Teagle Hall, which is imaged above here, built in 1951, and Helen Newman Hall, imaged below here, built in 1963. Teagle Hall was built as the male-only athletics facility, and Helen Newman was built as the converse, the female-only athletic facility. And even with modifications over time that have been made, there are inadequate bathrooms, showers for the opposite gender, as well as transgender and gender non-conforming persons. The pools are also not handicap accessible, and accessibility deficiencies to improve these facilities are really unrealistic and total around $6 million. What are the other issues that are facing the pools? The biggest one is really a supply and demand imbalance. So there is a huge demand on pool time at Cornell, and there's just simply the space or the hours in the day to meet that demand. So even though I had all those groups listed there, a lot of those groups, for example, club swimming or club water polo, only get maybe an hour or two per week, which is not what they would like. And there are groups on campus that can't get pool time that would like it. There have been increased pool closures that have increased in frequency starting a couple years ago, and a pool study was then done to look into the reason for that in 2019. And what they discovered was that the swimming pool turnover rate, which is the amount of time it takes all the water in the pool to go through the filtration system, is far longer than what the high pool usage and the number of people that are using these pools, and that's a likely contributor to the poor water quality. One proposed solution was reducing the number of pool users to try to improve the water quality. So therefore you have groups that maybe had more pool time that then are being told, no, sorry, you can't use the pools, as a way to try to alleviate this problem. Teagle Hall has a roof that is in damage and it has moisture issues and it needs replacing. That project is estimated at $10 to $12 million in cost, and would require all occupants to leave for a 10-month period that would have additional relocation costs as well. The roof overlying the pool in Teagle, it has asbestos material, so when there are leaks, that's obviously a safety concern. Teagle Hall, I'm also told, doesn't have a generator, and that's about $500,000. So anytime the power goes off in Teagle, that results in the machinery that functions the filters and filtration system, they shut down. And if it's for a long enough period of time, that will obviously impact water quality. All the water would have to be dumped and put waste and refilled the pool again. In 2020, the original estimate was $1.1 million that would be needed, and $750,000 was the actual cost for the improvements that were done. And these were really palliative measures. All that could be done was done at this point to try to prolong the life of the pool. And that's estimated at about 5 years, bringing us to 2025. Some of those improvements actually included structural support. So there are wood beams that are underneath the pools helping to support them. And the decision was made to use wood beams instead of the more costly steel, because it wouldn't be a wise investment that your steel beams would last longer than the pools themselves would. The process of approval, fundraising, planning, construction, a conservative estimate is that would take up to 10 years. And even if we started today, then that brings us at 2032 and a 7-year time span where Cornell may not have a pool on campus. I recently watched a video of University of Wisconsin's new pool, touring that. The head coach there is an old teammate of mine. And he said that really the conversations for that facility that they have now started 20 years ago. So we are really behind at Cornell. I've been asked when met with administrators, why am I pushing? Why do we think a 50-meter pool is necessary? And the reason for that is not just a luxury item that we'd like to have, is that it would actually solve the supply and demand issue that we have at Cornell. So I have two of our peer institutions' pools imaged here above Princeton, their pool built in 1990, and below Brown's, most recently built 10 years ago now in 2012. And what you could see is each of these pools has what's called a bulkhead, and that's this white structure that runs perpendicular to the 50-meter length of the pool. And that allows the pool to be separated into multiple sections. So you could have, for example, a phys ed class happening here, open swim happening here, and in the diving well have diving practice or scuba diving class in the diving well. So what you're doing is giving multiple groups pool time and at more optimal hours of the day. We heard President Pollack mention how much bigger Princeton's endowment is, and I think that that's a common counter argument for why this may not be feasible for Cornell. But if we look at our New York peer institutions, Ithaca College and Colgate University, with far less endowments than Brown or Princeton, they were able to make it happen. And they have beautiful 50-meter pools that you may be interested to find out as well were helped to be funded by Cornell alumni donors. So donors are out there. We simply need to ask and say that this is a need for our campus. I've also heard the idea, the notion that IC's pool is sitting there unused and it's this expensive thing that isn't being used. And that's simply untrue as well. They have the pool being used many hours of the day. And when the varsity teams at Cornell were not able to use Teagle or Helen Newman due to water quality issues, the time of day they were given to swim was from 8 to 10 p.m. at night. And when the water polo team tried to get pool time at IC when they were cut in the fall, they were told they could have 1 hour on a Sunday. Cornell needs a pool of this size, also just based on the number of people on our campus. Cornell, as it stands now, has about 2.5 times more faculty than IC and 4.5 times more students than IC. And as we've heard, there is plans for class size expansion. A Cornell University without a pool, in my mind, is simply, it would be an embarrassment. It's unacceptable. We would be the only Ivy League, non-Ivy peer in regional college or university without one. Many community colleges have a pool. The ones I grew up around did. TC3 has a pool. If we didn't have a pool on campus, that would involve the termination of all aquatic activities that I previously mentioned, including beginning at swimming at Cornell, which has 89.7% of its enrolled students are people of color. We know that participation in formal swimming lessons reduces drowning risk, and those drowning death rates are certainly higher for people of color due to generations of unequal access to pools and formal swimming lessons. Beginning swimming at Cornell receives high praise from students at end of year course evaluations. One student said, "I left the course gaining a whole new life skill. I had a few traumatic experiences with drowning as a child and never thought I would be able to learn how to swim." Students are getting over a fear of the water as young adults, which is incredible, and it's giving them a way to de-stress. One student wrote a Cornell Daily Sun article arguing against the swim test, only to then enroll in beginning swimming, learn how to swim, and then write a retraction column about her changed perspective. Last month, we heard from the VP of Student Campus Life that the potential of canceling or ending the swim test requirement for graduation. And I want to note that if that does happen, that and we want to make it optional for students to learn how to swim, they wouldn't even have the ability to electively sign up and learn how to swim in beginning swimming if we don't have a pool on campus. In 2020, as we know, Cornell published its Mental Health Review final report, and it stated what we know, that Cornell has a culture of competition that may take on an unhealthy cycle of expectation and behavior that can reach traumatizing levels for students, faculty, and staff. Under Section B, it was stated, it's important to note that when asked for their recommendations, undergraduate, graduate, and professional students consistently prioritize the need for access to free physical fitness opportunities to cope with stress and build resilience. And with Ithaca's climate, students want free and convenient indoor fitness options. Recommendation under well-being, I was thrilled to read then to prioritize fundraising for free physical fitness under affordability within the capital campaign. only to then read later the note of virtual fitness classes and virtual and augmented reality proposed in lieu of a fitness center. And it is seems to be stating the obvious, but we certainly, there's no virtual equivalent for aquatic activities, and I can't swim in my living room. I am pleased to hear President Pollack's update that there is the Student Access Fund to cover the cost of fitness center memberships, but it's important to note that swimming is free, free for all students, regardless of financial means. A new natatorium would do an enormous amount of good. It would benefit students, faculty and staff and retirees' physical and mental health. And despite talks of a new pool at Cornell since the 1980s and having pools that could fail at any time, a new natatorium is still not a university priority item and is not included in the capital campaign. The pools have simply been a problem that has been talked about and brushed aside and ignored for far too long. The capital campaign is the only way to prevent Cornell from having to pay for the entire project in the event of a catastrophic failure of our pools. So what we are asking for is the ability to reach major donors across all of Cornell, not just the athletic department, with the assistance of Alumni Affairs and Development to help make this project a reality. With that, I would like to thank the fellow Faculty Center co-sponsors who are listed here, as well as thank the support of the Faculty Advisory Committee on Athletics and Physical Education. I have the entire proposed resolution up here that I'm happy to keep up during discussion, and I'm more than happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Actually, there's a little noise in the room, so I muted the speakers here. But thank you so much for your presentation. Really insightful information. I'll give a small anecdote and then turn it to this image. I worked at Cornell for just over 16 years, and one of the first events that I worked in Cornell Catering was an event held in Helen Newman Hall that was designed to showcase how much Helen Newman Hall needed to be torn down and replaced 16 years ago. I remember it very distinctly. They brought in just enough trees for people to feel comfortable in the space and garnish it, but not so much to make it look nice because it needed a lot of work and investment. So with that, I'll turn it over to the assemblies, see if anybody has any questions for our presenters.
Just a point of personal privilege. We have the resolution in front of us, so we don't actually need to keep it up there.
Okay.
It's easier for the conversation.
Yes, we do have the resolution, and I believe that this evening we'll be hearing from Deborah Howe, who will be talking about resolution in support of it. But it's okay to leave that up there if you'd like. I'll turn it over to the floor. Any other questions? Jessica.
Thank you. Actually, I'm in the Campus Welfare Committee, and we've been looking at the resolution that the Faculty Senate wrote. And there's a lot of great research there, and I don't swim, but new pool sounds like a fantastic thing for staff. So, but one thing I noticed, I did not see anything about development. Your presentation tonight is the first time I've heard development, alumni affairs and development mentioned. Typically, development teams pick their campaign priorities before the campaign starts. So I'm wondering if you've talked with, and I don't know if it's athletics or student and campus life development. I'm not sure who is responsible for the pools. But basically, I'm wondering if you've talked with them and found out, you know, what priorities did they pick? Why did they not pick the pools?
Yeah, excellent question. So I have met with a number of people in doing research for this proposal as well as afterwards. And I've met with the athletic director, Andy Noel, and also met with Ryan Lombardi. And Ryan Lombardi, you know, his statement and Andy Noel, basically the number one ticket item that is happening is a new field house at Cornell. And that is going to have a basically indoor practice area for sports teams during the winter months and for varsity teams as well as club and intramural. My understanding is that there was simply a limitation of what could be asked for from the athletic department, and it wasn't like a give us all the things that you would like. It was give us what's realistic and what you already have major donors for. And the fact of the matter is, what I am told is that you don't have an item until there are these anchor donors in place. And right now, there are no anchor donors in place for a new pool. Andy Noel has certainly reached out to donors within the athletic department, but it is an expensive item, as President Pollack mentioned. I mean, a new pool, you're probably looking in the range of $50 million. And I think that our hope in this resolution is that we convey that a pool is used by so many more people than just the varsity team. So why are we only looking at varsity athletics alumni base to help fund a project that benefits everyone on Cornell's campus, from students to staff to retired faculty who live in Ithaca after they're done teaching? And by only having it be within the athletic department, we haven't even potentially asked people in the larger Cornell alumni base if they would have interest in donating to such a project.
Thank you.
Yes, Thomas.
Yeah, well, I sort of have a dog in this fight. I played water polo here for 4 years in the 60s and 70s, and the pool, of course, is completely inadequate for that with its shallow end, as I think you know. But what surprises me, I mean, I was unaware that the pools were in such dire condition. But presumably the athletic department knows this. In other words, this isn't coming as news to Andy Noel and other people, I assume.
No, I mean, no, it's certainly not new information.
What is their response to the prospect of Cornell without a pool?
Appalled, yeah. They're not obviously in support. And I think what really made this more of an issue that came to the forefront was around 2019 is really when the pools started having severe water quality issues.
I see. And so it's relatively recent that they got urgent.
Exactly. And the ask list for what do you want on the capital campaign, they were asked, that document was written a year prior, you know, prior to the pools really having a more acute decompensation, if you will, for the teams being out of the pool for, you know, days on end, and the varsity teams, for example, this fall having all of their meets at Ithaca College because the table water was unacceptable. So it's been more of a problem that's come to the light, but I think it's just always been, at least in my mind, I think it's an intimidating project to take on, and probably just something that has been like, yeah, they're old. You know, I mean, that's what President Pollack said. We know our pools are old. That's what I've heard my entire athletic career, as well as in my alumni years. And so I think now it's like, we can't afford to continue to ignore them.
Thank you. So Annalie, then Duncan, and Jacob. I'll go to Annalie first.
Yeah, my question, and I know this is really, really early in the stages, but I'm wondering if there's like a designated space or like thoughts of a space where like this pool would take place. Would that like proposition be to tear down Helen Newman, like the case that you mentioned?
Yeah, great question. It's my understanding that there is a space study that is currently undergoing. And so that is very much the question. Where would this go? Teagle Hall, I think because of it needing a new roof, it doesn't seem like a great investment to put $10 or $12 million to cover a building that otherwise is going to fail. So I certainly, it's my understanding that Teagle, the site where Teagle is being looked at, as well as potentially other sites. And I did meet with Lyle Gantz, who is the director of space and long range planning. And he looked over the proposal as well to verify its accuracy. And something that he has reminded me of is that, you know, the deterioration of facilities isn't always a linear process, right? It can be like, okay. And then, you know, kind of have a drop off. And I think that that's what we're experiencing.
Thank you.
I was just going to comment on Thomas's point. I've been working with Eva Zhang. She's one of the captains of the water polo team. She approached me, I'm forgetting when now, but like early last semester, exactly with the problem you highlighted. They've been practicing at Ithaca College, and as you heard in the presentation, that's clearly not feasible, let alone really intimidating to come face Cornell at our campus. So there's been a lot of issues with that for a long time, and to your point somewhat of how they've gotten responded back to athletics. Athletics knows the issue. The issue, though, is kind of speaks broader to students can often struggle to get meetings to even have a conversation about this, right? It's taken through the faculty center to kind of have that conversation of the facilities, often as a single team is only a team. So if you get a chance to reconnect with anyone on the polo team now, you'll probably hear.
Well, you know, it's funny you mention that, because You know, Bartels Hall is named for Phil Bartels' family. Phil
yes,
Bartels and I played water polo together. Does he know about this?
Phil Bartels does know about this. So there is a strong alumni swimming group. They're certainly aware. And I think ultimately the Bartels family feels like they have given a lot to Cornell, and
it's
no longer within his means to really be, again, another big anchor donor for another building.
Okay.
But he has been a wonderful supporter of the team over the years. He is the reason they can even do an away meet in the middle of the year at Akron.
Yeah.
So he's not his support at all. But yes, he is aware.
But he's not a proposed anchor donor for this because they're spent out. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Thank you, Thomas. And yeah, to Jacob and then to Rich.
Yeah, so you kind of already alluded to this. I think that many people also alluded to it as well. So you specifically noted, though, a seven-year period between 2025 an estimated seven-year period and 2032, during which Cornell, not only the swim team, but all our communities wouldn't even have access to any functional pool. What would be the fate of the varsity swim team during that time? Would there just not be a swim team? Would we solely be practicing at Ithaca College? And the other thing is, I think that competition could be a good thing. And I think that one of the most important points that he brought up is we'd be the only college in the Ivy League, let alone, when looking at our peer institutions that don't have a pool. And that is absurd, in my opinion. And that alone is a reason why I will end up supporting this. But I'm curious, that's my first question. So,
yeah, absolutely. So, I know a little thing about recruiting. My husband does that for a living. And so it would be nearly impossible, I think, to try to recruit student athletes to a school that doesn't have a pool. He has a hard enough time recruiting athletes at Teagle, and they have to not judge a book by its cover, and they love Cornell for other reasons. I think the administration's backup plan probably is trying to get pool time at ISC, but that's really limited. And there were students emailing Ryan Lombardi this academic year saying, why is my kid having to practice from 8 to 10 p.m. at night only to then have to wake up and obviously maintain their academic load? So it's not a great alternative, but my guess is that's the backup plan. You would hope that both pools wouldn't fail at the same time. So then maybe you would be having a period where you have just Helen Newman and not Teagle, for example. I also look at the pools as an issue for faculty recruitment and retention. I mean, if you're a faculty member trying to decide if you want to, work at Cornell or work at Brown, and swimming is an important part of your, fitness for mental and or physical health, that's going to impact your decision. So if the president is, prioritizing endowing new faculty positions and bringing faculty on board, I think this would help bring faculty on board. It would certainly help me, and I know many other faculty in the Vet College who swim and who have to swim at the YMCA, for example. I know faculty in CALS who choose to swim and they pay for membership at Island Fitness to try to fit in time because the open swim hours have become so unpredictable with the closures.
Thank you, Jake. I'll take one more question and then we'll move on.
Thanks, Ashley. You presented to the Faculty Senate and that was a really fine presentation. I think this is an even better one, but
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. The president earlier, I don't know whether you were online or not.
But I was, yes.
The president earlier said that Cornell does not do what donors want. And yet, in your presentation, it looks like they're not doing what donors do not want. The first question is, is that a fair characterization of the situation? The second thing is, at the Faculty Senate, your presentation was just before a presentation abolishing the swim test. And I thought to myself, as I watched the two presentations, that they were connected. That, in fact, the abolishing the swim test would support their refusal not to fund the pool, and that they occurred conjunctly, adjacently in the presentation for that reason. I'm not going to ask you to comment on that. I'm just
I'm happy to.
I don't want you to.
The next thing is really a suggestion in your presentation, which I really love. When you say when it's $50 million, you should step back for a moment and tell people how long the pool would last. Because it's an amortized expense. It's something that it depreciates over years, that's true, but the benefit is over a long period of time as well. And so I would, that's just a suggestion for your presentation, because I wish you all the best of luck.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the suggestion. I will comment on the three things I believe you mentioned. So one on alumni funding. I mean, I think it's fair that, I guess, that President Pollack said they don't necessarily determine university policy based on the opinion of one alumni, right, or alumna. But in terms of facilities, I think if you have someone that says, I want to, you know, give you this money to build this, they will do it. Regardless of if it's a true need. And a great example of that is the wrestling facility that we have. There was clearly someone who wanted to give money to build a wrestling facility. And I don't really know of any other solitary facilities devoted solely to the sport of wrestling, but it exists here at Cornell because someone was willing to spend for that. So, you know, in my mind, it's tough. This is something that serves such a larger proportion of our Cornell population. And it's just a matter of finding that person or persons to help make it a reality. As for the swim test, yeah, I mean, I have to fully admit, you know, the skeptical side of me is like, gosh, if we don't require beginning swimming, then yeah, we really don't have to have a pool on campus, do we? I certainly hope that that is not the case. And I tried to mention here that even if it's not required, which I absolutely see both sides of the argument, I really do. But in my mind, it's like it needs to still be an option for people who want to learn how to swim. And if we don't have a pool on campus, that's not an option. So that was also, I think, an interesting order of the agenda for the two. I was not a part of that presentation, nor were they a part of my presentation. And then let's see, the last thing was the longevity. Absolutely. These pools will serve generations and generations of Cornell, you know, student and faculty. And, you know, like I said, hopefully I will be able to swim in it someday and maybe when I retire, and I hope my kids will someday too. And so absolutely, I think it's hard and it's certainly not my area of expertise to know how long a building like this would last, but we know that Teagle and Helen Newman, which I don't think were necessarily state of the art. I don't know if at that time they were. Teagle's 71 years old. Helen Newman's 59 years old. So I think that it's a good investment in my mind. And I said this to Ryan Lombardi, and I believe it with my whole heart, that a pool is the type of thing, if you build it, they will come. I have never seen a pool in all the, you know, pools that I saw in the DC, Maryland, Virginia area growing up not go to use. They absolutely are used by community members for all sorts of purposes.
Thank you very much, Ashley. Thank you for the questions, everyone. I just wanted to note that we had an item before, but I'd like to move up the next item here to be our UA Resolution 5. If there are no objections, I'd like to move that forward before we talk about students' expectations. Seeing none, then I will turn over to Deborah Howe. Thank you, Ashley, for the presentation and everyone for the questions. And I'll turn it over to Deborah Howe, who will speak to UA Resolution 5.
Thank you, Brandon. Should I share my screen for the resolution, or do folks have it?
We have it here in the packet. Would anybody like to share on the screen? No, we're good here.
Okay. So I am presenting you, and I'm sorry, I am sick. So if you can't understand me, Jessica Withers is in person offering to translate. Not COVID, though. Yeah. So this is UA Resolution 5. It's from the brought forward by the Campus Welfare Committee in support of the Faculty Senate proposed resolution for inclusion and prioritization of a new natatorium in the Do the Greatest Good capital campaign, which Ashley just so excellently presented on. So what I'd like to bring is to bring this up as new business and ask that the assembly review it and give any feedback changes to me, hoping that I can bring it back next time for vote. In our resolution are things specific to the Campus Welfare Committee and why we support the Faculty Senate resolution. It also includes as Appendix A some additional background information directly related to campus welfare, and then a copy of, in Appendix B, the Faculty Senate resolution. This is also my first time doing this, so if I missed anything, please let me know and ask questions. Are there no questions?
Yeah, sorry, we got muted accidentally there, Deborah. Sorry about that. I'll turn it back. I said thank you for the presentation, and I open the floor now to questions, so I'll turn it down.
Yeah, this was just an amendment to add myself as a co-sponsor, so it goes along with the version that's in the box. The original intention was that all welfare committee members and there was would be co-signed, and then there would also be a member from each constituency. So I would then add the undergraduate constituency to that. So I'd like to motion to that amendment.
To add to Duncan, you're in there.
Yeah, no, I'm talking about the printed version we got out here was a little different.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, I saw your email. I know we communicated about that earlier. I was just making sure it was the same on the floor for everyone else here.
Oh, I see. So the box folder has the latest one. There were two changes, adding Duncan to the sponsored by, and I received an updated version of the Faculty Senate resolution that was updated in Appendix B. And in the box folder, there's a note that it was updated yesterday.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, our apologies for the printed version, but the one that's linked both on the agenda that everybody received and that's on the website goes to the amended version that Deborah just so that you're on that, and it includes the updated Faculty Senate resolution. Our apologies.
So would that then, would you then see that resolution?
Yeah, would we need to do this amendment then?
No, just I think okay. As long as for the record we're referencing the online version that's linked from the agenda and not the paper version.
Very discreet in the box.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
So we just ask if you would like to continue with the motion or?
No, I reject the motion.
All right, any other comment or questions from the floor, from the assembly? If there are none, I would entertain a motion to table this to the next meeting to allow, as usual, we ask that we have opportunity to provide comments to the resolution presenters. If there are any feedback between now and the next meeting, to then vote on it at the next one. So
it's
motion.
Yeah, I'll motion to table resolution 5 to the next meeting.
Okay. We have a motion by Duncan and seconded by Jessica. With that, I would take all those in favor of tabling to the next meeting. Raise your placard for all those on Zoom to green checkbox. We'll give Casey a moment. All right, and then any opposed? Maybe up for the approval. All right, and then abstentions. And with that, the motion passes the table to the next meeting. So thank you, Deborah, and please feel better.
Thank you, and a big thank you to Ashley for making my job so easy tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. This is my first go at any sort of resolution either, so thanks for your support.
The learning curves on resolutions are fast, aren't they? All right, we'll move on to the rest of our agenda here. I just wanted to make a brief note in regards to attendance and ensure that all are aware of the bylaws for attendance of our meetings at the Assembly, and that the intention of those attendance expectations are to ensure adequate representation for all constituency groups, that the governing documents ask that you either provide notice 24 hours in advance if you are unable to meet the meeting, and if possible, miss no more than two meetings in a session. And that a session is not divided by semesters. Our session is for the entire year. As all of us were seated for an entire year, of the 2022 fall, or 21 fall to the 22 spring. So just a reminder, folks, that the expectations are there to ensure we have adequate representation in the conversation, ensure the work that we can, the important work we can do here, need to do here, continues. Are there any questions as it pertains to attendance expectations? All right, seeing none, we'll move on to our assembly reports. We are shy on time, so I will, as usual, allow for assemblies that are constituencies, if you would like to pass, if you don't have any important updates, that's okay. But we'll keep an eye on time if they need to extend. So I'll turn first to Annalie for the student assembly report.
Hi, everyone. So we've had quite a few things go through the student assembly in the last week or two. So I just wanted to check in with you all. So we approved a $5,000 allocation to the Chinese Student Scholars Association, which they used for their New Year festival that happened last week, which was really great. It was well attended by student assembly members. And we thought it was a really great way to just increase diversity and representation on our campus. We also had a resolution that was co-sponsored by Representative Katie talking about Zoom live transcriptions and just like urging faculty members to use live transcriptions when they're doing Zoom meetings for accessibility reasons for students. We established the Public Health and Safety Committee to the Student Assembly, which is connected really closely to PSAC, which is Public Safety Advisory Committee. I know Facebook just joined the last session. And basically, it's going to be from the Student Advisory Board that helps with student participation, just because there are a certain amount of student allocation seats for PSAC. So just making sure that we get that student input. We also approved special projects funding for POD Podcasts, which is an organization on our campus. They got $400 in approved funding, and they're going to make themselves into a nonprofit. That's what they're using the money for. And basically, it's to just increase accessibility to podcasts for students on campus, so students doing any of that research. And then we had a resolution that ended up failing. It was tabled. I'm so sorry. Tabled indefinitely. Which was to establish U.S.-China Friendship Day, which would have been this previous Monday, so yesterday, which basically some of the contention around the resolution was just trying to figure out how to like support Chinese American students on our campus and Chinese international students without really engaging in international policy. So a big chunk of the resolution had a lot to do with reaching out to ambassadors and also like engaging kind of in that foreign policy, also asking President College to do that. So I think right now we're redrafting the resolution just to make sure that we're focusing on how we can be supportive for students on campus, and it's connected a lot to like anti-Asian people in the United States. But that's where the essay is right now.
Great, thank you very much. Any questions for Anna? Yeah.
My mask on before I speak. I'm curious about the, so you mentioned Chinese ambassadors got involved. Speak a little bit more on that last thing.
Yes. Okay. So, U.S.-China Friendship Day, I'm still trying to do a little bit of research on it, but it was proposed by our international students representative who basically discussed how that's like a significant day, especially in China, which is February 21st, which like established U.S.-China like foreign relations. So I think the goal and intention with that resolution was basically like a lot of like the pretense to it was like anti-Chinese and anti-Asian hate that's like surrounded with the COVID-19 pandemic in ways to kind of like reaffirm to the university students that we are in support of Chinese students. I think where the controversy came up and that was most of our discussion was the way that they went about that was to say that we were going to write a letter on behalf of President Pollock to the Chinese ambassador to the United States, and then also engaging a lot of kind of foreign policy aspects. So I think people wanted to focus a lot, or at least like from my perspective, but wanted to focus on how to support students on campus as opposed to getting involved in international policy, which I think like, just being honest, like this is a conversation that's been going through the faculty summit that has been involved in UN politics. And I don't think that's wanting to get involved in that international discussion.
adjacent to the Crescent Creek Gallery. All right, well, then we'll move to the GPSA. Preston?
Yeah, so I'll keep it brief. We've been, still working through different housekeeping issues. But I will say the only resolution that we've had come out in the last 2 weeks is last night we passed a resolution, Resolution 13, commending the service of Wendy. So that was super awesome that we got through that last night. So that's about it. Yeah.
Well, what a wonderful resolution. Thank you very much, Preston. Any questions for Preston? Yes, okay.
Is Resolution 13 online for student assembly representatives to rip off and pass on Thursday?
Yeah, I can trust
you. Thank you. I have to strip that from the record next.
All right, we'll move to the employee assembly. Yeah, right, Jessica?
I will just quickly say that we had our staff forum I told you all about a couple of weeks ago. This was COVID in the new semester. It was part of a communication plan. Senior leadership had town halls with various schools across campus, and this employee assembly forum was to make sure that all staff had a chance to hear the latest on the spring semester from leadership. So we had lower attendance than we normally do, 625 attendees, and about 50 pre-submitted in live questions, but was very grateful for the staff forum and for leadership's willingness to have this with opportunity for all staff. That's about that.
Thank you. Any questions for Jessica?
May I make just a quick comment to put the 600 some staff in perspective? For a Zoom during COVID, maybe that's less than, but that's more than we ever got in person or a president's address to staff. So having 600 plus staff members participate was.
Yeah,
it was well done. So thank you.
It was great.
Thank you, Dean. Thank you for the addition. Any other questions or comments for Jessica? All right. With that, we'll move to E for the Faculty Senate.
Hi, Jessica. I was going to say 600 is really impressive. I would be so pleased if that happened for me. As you guys have heard, we had two discussions surrounding the pool, and that was purposeful because the same data are used for multiple perspectives on whether we should have a new pool, whether we should eliminate or keep the swim requirement. So that was to initiate a discourse in an evidence-based way. And so we're gonna continue that conversation. And I think I'll give you guys an update in 2 weeks when we're ready for our March 9th Faculty Senate meeting.
Thank you very much. Eva, a question from Preston?
I wanted the motion to extend the meeting by 10 minutes.
Thank you very much for keeping an eye on that time. We have a motion to extend by 10 minutes. So I have a second.
Sorry.
Seconded by Jacob. Any opposed? All right, seeing none, we'll continue. Thank you. You have anything else to add there?
No, I'm good.
Turn to Jacob for the executive committee report.
Yeah, we discussed a few things. Just we finished up at our last meeting organizing those questions for President Pollack that you all heard today. We also just discussed very briefly the attendance expectations, which Brandon had touched on. And that is pretty much it from what I remember, at least, as a means of saving time for others.
Any questions for Jacob? Seeing none, we'll move to James for the Codes and Judicial Committee.
Hello, everyone. So I'll keep this short and sweet because of time, obviously. But by tonight, all CJC members should have received an email with the doodle poll for our next meeting, which is going to be either this coming week or the following one. This meeting is super important because it will discuss legislation, which has been drafted by Richard Bensel and myself, containing major changes to the UA bylaws regarding the CJC. The first major change is that this legislation will specify the changes to the CJC's role under the new student code of conduct. Essentially, just as a sneak peek, we no longer have the power to recruit and appoint UHRP members. That's been delegated to the director of the OSCCS and executive committees. But the CJC will potentially retain the power to review and discuss those motions related to the code of conduct. And importantly, we'll also be potentially given authority to review any concerns regarding implementation of the code of conduct and to request periodic reports from the respondent codes counselors on the implementation of the code. So the reason that we're making this change is because of the concerns that reducing the campus code of conduct to the student code of conduct has removed the ability of an independent body that isn't, you know, within the administration to ensure the principles of the student code of conduct are applied to the entire Cornell community, not just the students. So we think that the CJC will hopefully fill this space. And the second major change is basically that the committee be changed to reflect the new code. So obviously the current name is the Cogent Judicial Committee, but we're proposing changing that to the Campus Code Committee to reflect the changes that I just described.
Thank you, James. Any questions for James? Appreciate you getting those meeting schedules. We can continue to work there with the CJC, soon to be something different. All right, and then next up, Deborah with the Campus Welfare Committee, if there's anything you'd like to add.
Nothing to add. The resolution has been our focus. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. And now I'll turn to Ian for the site.
No updates from site today.
All right. Do we have any liaison reports?
I have a brief liaison report from CNC.
Okay, go ahead.
So CNC met last week. Three principal items were discussed. Firstly, Ben Furness, Cornell Class of 06, is going to be joining the campus sustainability team from the New York City Mayor's Office to launch a new initiative called the 2030 Project. The 2030 Project will principally be concerned with figuring out how to best coordinate synergies across the whole university for maximum effectiveness and identifying places where Cornell can reduce emissions, remove greenhouse gases from the atmosphere, and best address other climate change concerns. Second, just a brief note on the Carbon Sinks Evaluation Group, some discussion of finding a group leader. That process is still ongoing, and hopefully we'll be meeting at a future date to try to actually determine who that leader is going to be. And then just lastly, there was a Cubo update. As President Pollack mentioned, Cornell did recently secure a $7.2 million grant from the Department of Energy for drilling. However, what was also discussed at the update is that there's going to be an additional $4 to $5 million needed to complete drilling and testing of Cubo. Right now, that funding has not been identified. And there's a possibility of looking at a naming grant initiative. Additionally, there was some other discussion about the long-term costs thrown around with actually implementing the Earth Source Heating Plan. So beyond Cubo, the first well pair demonstration is likely to cost about $25 to $35 million. And then the additional well pairs necessary to actually implement Earth Source Heating to heat the whole campus, looking at a price tag of $75 to $115 million, and that's to achieve the 50 megawatt thermal base load demand estimated to be necessary to power the campus. That's all I have.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Ian?
A lot of swimming pools.
Yes, Richard.
Ian, does this mean that the whole project is at risk?
You know, based on the discussion in the meeting, the impression I was left with was not that the project was at risk. The presenters from Cornell Engineering seemed fairly confident that they'd be able to come up with this extra $4 to $5 million. They didn't seem concerned, but it is an item to be conscious of as the project proceeds, because it will be needed, you know, in the short term of the next couple of years to finish testing and viability.
Any other questions for Ian? Just a note, I saw the transcription say 45 million, so I'm just going to say this for Casey to catch that. There's 425 million there, so make sure you get that in the notes too. Not another 45 million that they're looking for in that. All right, and any other liaison reports? No? All right, with that, before I ask for any other additions, just want to acknowledge this is Wendy's last meeting here with the University Assembly Group. So, I'm sure, Wendy, you're on a farewell tour there. We greatly appreciate everything that you have done for us here in the University Assembly. Thank you so much for everything, and we wish you all the best. I wish you all the best in your new role.
So thank you all for making my job easy and being a part of everything that you all do. And as I said last night and recently, just going to the vet school, dairy bar, ice cream. That's
take a hike.
There you go. I'll be happy to meet you at the dairy bar sometime, Wendy. So thank you so much. With that, I would entertain a motion to adjourn or any other item. Motion from Damian, any seconds? Seconded by Jacob. Any objections? All right, that meeting adjourned.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.